Hello, everyone. Welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, August 7th. We've survived Labor Day, having a gorgeous day in Fort Dodge. It's currently 79 degrees and beautiful sunny day. We'll look at a more detailed forecast as we conclude our time together. In the meantime, let's go ahead and take a look at today's articles from the Messenger. Tradition is the title of the first one. The 84th Annual Dayton Championship Rodeo wrapped up on Monday afternoon in front of a crowd of several thousand rodeo fans. A year after having to cancel the rodeo for the first time in its eight decades, rodeo chairman Matt Johnson was pleased with how the 2021 Dayton Rodeo weekend went. "We couldn't have asked for better weather," he said. "It was better than we expected all the way around. It was a great rodeo and a great event for Dayton." Each of the four nights of the rodeo brought enough people to more than triple the population of the small Webster County town. While the estimated 9,000 tickets sold over the four-day rodeo wasn't a record turnout, "It was still darn good, and everyone seemed to enjoy themselves," Johnson said. "We've had some great feedback. It's the best show they've seen here in years. Everything I heard was positive this year." Greg and Beverly Swecker of Dana came to the Dayton Rodeo and come each year. "It's a tradition," she said. "It's a family event. It's a good place to bring your kids for traditional entertainment." Greg enjoys watching the bull riding events. Both he and his wife are looking forward to the next Dayton Rodeo. "It takes a full year of planning and around 100 volunteers to put together the annual Labor Day Rodeo. It's a lot," Johnson said. "I've been down here for the last month and a half getting everything ready." In just a few weeks, the Dayton Rodeo Celebration Committee will start planning the 2022 celebration, which is set for September 2nd through the 5th, 2022. And there's a variety of photos in the newspaper. There's a picture of Shelby Sorensen, age 15. She was the Dayton Wrangler Junior Queen at the 2021 Championship Rodeo. There's a picture of a team attempting to rein in their horse during the wild horse race at the Dayton Championship Rodeo. There's another picture of a competitor who gets dragged by his horse during the wild horse race at the Dayton Championship Rodeo. And there's another picture of a saddle bronc rider as he's holding on to his horse, or tries to hold on to his horse, as the horse attempts to throw him off. So all sorts of action going on at the Dayton Rodeo. Building bridges is the title of the next article. Volunteers are needed for this mentoring program. It doesn't take much to impact a life, make a positive impact on a kid's life. For the mentors with the Bridges Mentoring Program at the Fort Dodge Community School District, it just takes about an hour a week. The Bridges Program, which was started in 1994, pairs an adult in the Fort Dodge community with a student in the Fort Dodge schools who just needs a little extra support and encouragement. We're not trying to replace anybody. We're just trying to add a positive role model to the young person's life, said Corey Moody, student services and case manager at Senior High. "We have so many kids that just need a lot of assurance and have a lot of needs." Students are referred to Moody by their teachers, counselors, principals, and parents. The students range from elementary school all the way through high school. "There's never a shortage of students in need of a mentor," Moody said. "However, there is a shortage of adults volunteering to be mentors. I have a waiting list for every school," he said. "So we're just looking to recruit, replace, and kind of rebuild from last year in the schools." During the height of the pandemic, mentors weren't able to go into the schools to see their students. Many kept in touch through phone calls and video chats, but it's not quite the same, and now more kids are struggling. As young people return to school and reconnect with teachers, coaches, and classmates, we are reminded of the critical role that caring adult relationships have in their success. Our kids now more than ever need a web of supportive relationships to guide them. I think it's just a stressful time for kids, he added. About 95% of the district students are back in the classroom, he said. We have kids in our buildings that haven't been in school for over 500 days, he said. Moody said there are about 30 students on the mentoring waiting list right now. Ideally, he'd like to be able to pair each student on the list with a mentor and have a reserve roster of people willing to mentor for students who are referred to the program throughout the school year. Any kid in this building could use another person just to guide them, support them, be there for them, have another person in your corner, Moody said. To volunteer as a mentor, those interested just need to fill out a mentoring application and go through a simple background check. Once approved, Moody will work with them to find a good match with a student and do a short training with the mentor before they go into school. The time commitment is just about 45 minutes to an hour per week. Most mentors just visit their students at school during the school day, sometimes even just over a lunch break. They'll chat, help them with their homework, play games, read to them, whatever works best for the pairings. It's not so much what you do, it's taking the time to do it, said Moody. Each student's needs are different. I have mentors that are doing some things outside of school with the parents' permission, Moody said. Building the relationship between the student and the mentor starts right away. Moody likes to make those pairings when the students are in elementary school and see them grow throughout the years. The younger the connection, the better they build rapport and connections as they get older, he said. The goal is if it's a good connection, they'll stay with the same student throughout the years. We've had matches start in first, second, or third grade and that go on to graduate high school, which is pretty cool. In 27 years of Bridges, the impact of the program is clear. I've had a couple that had a mentor when they were little and have now become a mentor themselves, Moody said. Moody encourages any adult to be a mentor. It doesn't take any special training or knowledge. Mentors don't need to be an expert in kids. I would say any positive person can mentor at any age. I have college students that are mentoring, and we also have retired people that have a lot to give to our young people. People from all walks of life can be a mentor. Moody said he'd like to see more volunteers from the workforce working in trades become mentors. Matt Harvey of Matt Harvey Construction has been mentoring with Bridges for the past decade. He's worked with three students. The first moved away. His second graduated last year. And he's working with a senior at senior high right now. You learn so much from them, Harvey said. I think I get more out of it than he does. To apply to be a mentor, call Moody at 515-574-5469 or email cmoody, that's the letter C, Moody, at fdschools.org. Two men have been arrested after a multi-county high-speed pursuit that topped out at over 130 miles per hour on Sunday evening. Amarian Isom, 18, was driving a vehicle with two passengers on 360th Street near Madison Avenue. Near Harcourt when Webster County Deputy Dan Charleston initiated a traffic stop shortly before 8 o'clock p.m. Charleston said Isom initially pulled over but took off at a high rate of speed southbound on Highway 169 as Charleston approached the vehicle. The 25-minute pursuit went through Boone County and ended in Minburn in Dallas County. Charleston said deputies attempted to stop the vehicle using stop sticks but were unsuccessful. The pursuit eventually ended when Isom lost control while turning a corner in Minburn and collided with a parked car. He then fled on foot and was apprehended by Charleston after a short foot chase. Charleston said Isom was charged with several charges related to eluding officers as well as drug charges. He also had an active warrant out of Illinois. One of the vehicle's passengers was also arrested. Nizier Evans was charged with possession of a stolen weapon after a .22-caliber long rifle was found in the car's trunk during a search. Charleston said the firearm was found to have been stolen from Bemrick Electric in Fort Dodge back during the June 2013 fire at the business. Isom was previously charged with felony eluding and drug charges following an incident in Hamilton County on March 1st. Got some pictures from the Dayton Rodeo. There's a picture of J.C. Wren of Knoxville, who is the Dayton Wrangler Senior Queen, Monday at the 2021 Dayton Championship Rodeo. She's riding a beautiful horse, and she is wearing a gorgeous turquoise cowboy hat. There's another picture of cowboy Ricky Williams of Decatur, Alabama. He holds on during bareback riding at the Dayton Championship Rodeo, also on Monday afternoon. And it sure looks like he's about to get flung right off the horse. Click on more local news. We'll see what other articles we have to read. The Dayton Labor Day Parade was also held. There's a picture of Webster County Supervisor Mark Campbell along with Webster County Treasurer Brenda Engstrom. They spent Monday morning tossing out thousands of tiny rubber balls during the Dayton Labor Day Parade. The bouncy balls are a crowd favorite. Not Their First Rodeo is the title of the next article. The 84th Annual Labor Day Dayton Championship Rodeo continued Sunday night for the third night of the rodeo, complete with bronc riding, steer wrestling, mutton busting, bull riding, and more. Thousands of rodeo fans filled the bleachers around the Dayton Rodeo Arena to watch cowboys and cowgirls compete in the 84th Annual Rodeo. Tanner Crum and Amanda Ramsey came all the way from Ankeny to watch the show. "We always go to rodeos," Crum explained. A native of Van Meter, he used to compete in team roping and steer wrestling at rodeos around southern Iowa. "There's always good talent on display at the Dayton Rodeo," Crum and Ramsey said. "You're getting the best of the best," Crum said. "This is one of the best rodeos in Iowa," Ramsey added. The pair said they visited a rodeo hosted by the Dayton Wrangler Saddle Club last July and saw about 300 people at the event. They said they were blown away by Sunday's turnout, with people sitting all up and down the iconic hillside at the arena. Crum enjoys watching the rough stock events, and Ramsey likes to see the bareback and bull riding. "It's a big rodeo. They do very well," Crum said. The rodeo was to finish on Monday, starting with the Dayton Labor Day Parade. The free kids corral in the park was open as well, and the rodeo was to kick off at 1:30. There's lots of pictures associated with this article. There's a picture of Brody Wells of Wyoming holding on during a saddle bronc riding event at the Dayton Championship Rodeo. There's a picture of Landon Sivertson of South Dakota. He leaps onto a steer during steer wrestling during the Dayton Championship Rodeo Sunday night. There's a picture of Gizmo McCracken, the rodeo clown. That's Gizmo McCracken, the rodeo clown, having fun at the Dayton Championship Rodeo. There's another picture of a cowboy leaping onto a steer during the steer wrestling. And another picture of cowboy Jake Foster holding on during the bronc riding at the Dayton Championship Rodeo. A drive-by birthday party is being planned coming up. That will be our next article from Livermore. A drive-by Cy-Hawk-themed birthday party is being planned for a Livermore woman battling brain cancer. The family of Teresa Coleman Seafried is encouraging friends, neighbors, and community members to drive by her father Dave Coleman's house at 108 Fifth Avenue in Livermore on September 9th to wish her a happy birthday. It's a Cy-Hawk theme because the Iowa Hawkeyes versus Iowa State Cyclones football game is on Saturday, said Tracy Coleman Foster, Teresa's sister. "We want people to honk and to wave. She turns 53, so we are hoping for 53 cars at least, from fire departments to police departments or anyone from the community who knows Teresa or who wants to show their respect." Coleman Seafried was diagnosed with glioblastoma multiforme grade 4 in April. She underwent treatment for 42 days starting in June. In early August, she started home for hospice for comfort and assistance. Coleman has worked at Kossuth Regional Medical Center in Algona, Kossuth Regional Health Center in Algona, for more than 13 years. Dave describes his daughter as kind and generous. "She would help anyone in need of help," he said. "Very kind, generous, and lovable person. I love her dearly." Coleman said the support from the Algona Hospital has been tremendous. "The Algona Hospital has been great. People from Humboldt, Bode, Laverne, Corwith have helped in different ways. Taking her to chemo, just so many people. I guess I've never been so humble in my life as I am now." Coleman said her sister is a dedicated and loving parent. "She is smart, beautiful, hardworking, dedicated, and a proud mother," she said. Her adult son, Justin, is a U.S. Army veteran who served in Afghanistan 10 years ago. Her adult daughter, Samantha, has advanced her career in the spa industry. Coleman said her sister can bring a smile to anyone. "Teresa is very funny, sassy, and always been a prankster," Coleman said. "Her family and co-workers can tell stories of her pranks. She loves her work family at Kossuth Regional Health Center. As a sister, mother, daughter, and friend, Teresa is always there to support family and friends and would give as much as she could. She never asked for anything and always helped those in need. Her favorite furry companion is her dog Lucky, a 7-year-old Great Pyrenees. The family welcomes anyone to say hello to Teresa by sending cards to her in Livermore. The drive-by party is at 6 o'clock on Thursday at 108 Fifth Avenue, Livermore, to support Teresa Coleman Seafried. On Parade in Dayton is another picture from the Dayton Rodeo. Shows a picture of Matt Johnson, chairman of the Dayton Rodeo Committee, demonstrating the concept of other duties as prescribed Monday morning as he helps out with cleanup duties at the Dayton Labor Day Parade. Let's go ahead and take a look at From Our Files. From Our Files takes us back to September 2006, 15 years ago. There's a picture of Iowa Central Community College sophomore Bradley Claytor of Des Moines looking over his class schedule as he walks to class Wednesday morning. Ryan Ronan of Lone Tree and Ryan O'Leary of Fort Dodge stayed busy at their help desk post located near Bradley. In a second version of the From Our Files, there's a picture of Gene Sommerfeld, who is the new principal at St. Paul Lutheran School. He had recently moved to Fort Dodge from St. Cloud, Minnesota, and had started his duties. We will head over to the Messenger editorial page. The Afghanistan withdrawal has been a disaster. Here's what the Biden administration needs to do now. And this column is written by Joni Ernst, a Republican senator who represents Iowa. Last week, the American people faced a surreal and gut-wrenching reality. America left our own behind. The president broke a promise to our citizens and to those who bravely served alongside us as he ended the U.S. mission in Afghanistan and the Taliban celebrated. Right now, President Biden and his administration need to finish the evacuation. Americans, Afghan partners, and at-risk personnel are still in the country. I'm pressing the Biden administration for answers on the status and safety of American citizens, green card holders, and special immigrant visa applicants left behind in Afghanistan. And I will continue pressuring Congress to ensure the administration has all the authorities they need to bring Americans to safety, along with our Afghan allies. That includes full implementation of my bipartisanship bill with Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen to provide immediate improvements to and strengthen the efficiency of the Afghan SIV program. This will help make sure we are fully vetting our Afghan partners, while maintaining safety here at home. The Biden administration also needs to recognize that Afghanistan could soon return to being a hotbed for terrorist activities. It's abundantly clear those wishing to do us harm are still in the region. As we've already seen, the Haqqani Network, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS-K are all emboldened. The Biden administration just let billions of dollars in weapons and military equipment fall into the hands of the Taliban. I've called for a full accounting of the military equipment that has been seized by the Taliban and an assessment of how long it will take the Taliban to use the equipment. I've also pressed the Pentagon to evaluate the likelihood that the Taliban will seek to work with Russia, Pakistan, Iran, or the People's Republic of China for training, fuel, or infrastructure necessary to utilize the equipment they do not have the capabilities to use on their own. It's imperative we have a thorough understanding of the Taliban's military capabilities and in turn create a new counterterrorism strategy that takes into account the looming threats in Afghanistan. In order to counter other adversaries like China and Russia, we also need to take immediate action to strengthen and reassure our relationships with allies, partners, and those questioning our reliability. Lastly, we've already seen the calls to veteran suicide hotlines increase since the fall of Kabul. As a combat veteran, I know firsthand how emotional and disturbing the scenes in Afghanistan have been for so many. For more than 2 million veterans serving during the global war on terror, including more than 800,000 in Afghanistan, and these service members deserve and earned the support that they need. I've led a bipartisan effort with more than 33 of my Senate colleagues calling on the Department of Veterans Affairs to swiftly develop and conduct concurrent outreach to veterans of the global war on terror, and especially those who served in Afghanistan, providing them with the mental health resources they need. We must fulfill our obligation to those who served by giving these heroes the best quality care and support possible. One final word to these men and women who served in Afghanistan and who've protected our homeland over the last 20 years. Your sacrifices and that of your families have made a difference for so many. Your impact will never be forgotten. Thank you. And again, that's a column written by U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican who represents Iowa. There's an editorial in today's Messenger. It's a good day to recall past struggles for economic fairness. That is the title of the Messenger editorial. This was in September 6th newspaper. To most Americans in 21st century America, Labor Day is not an especially important holiday. It marks the unofficial end of summer. As such, it affords a three-day weekend to pursue summertime passions one last time before the weather cools. For most of us, it has little additional meaning. It may come as a surprise to many contemporary Americans, therefore, to learn that Labor Day became a national holiday during an era characterized by great conflict between organized labor and the business community. The decision to create the holiday was, in part, an act of conciliation. The late 19th century was a time when a fierce struggle was taking place regarding the structure of the workplace in industrial America. Workers were engaged in an often violent struggle with corporate employers about how the profits generated in a booming economy would be divided between laborers and owners. This was a time when labor unions were emerging as a major force in both the marketplace and the political life of the nation. Unions seem commonplace to us today, but in the last two decades of the 19th century, their role was controversial and occasioned bitter confrontations. Leaders in the labor movement sought governmental acknowledgement of its legitimacy throughout the 1880s and 1890s. In many states, holidays celebrating the contribution workers were making to the nation's economic and social progress were adopted. By 1894, Labor Day was a holiday in 23 states. The legislation approved by Congress on June 28, 1894, established Labor Day as a national holiday, was an attempt by President Grover Cleveland and his supporters in Congress to show respect for the labor movement. It came during a year when the president had incurred much hostility in labor circles by using federal troops to halt a railroad workers' strike. Many historians view the creation of this national holiday as an attempt at conciliation at a time of much conflict regarding the role of unions. All of that seems very remote from our world on Labor Day 2021. That workers should be treated with respect, compensated fairly, provided with appropriate benefits, and assured a safe work environment are accepted norms in our society. As you celebrate the last of summer on this holiday, take a few moments to say a silent thank you to the men and women whose battles for social and economic justice help mold the remarkable society in which we are privileged to live. And that is the Messenger editorial. From the Daily Freeman Journal, picture postcards have been a popular means of reaching out to family and friends for more than 150 years. Revered by travelers who document road trip stops, or special memories along the way. A new project seeks to share some of the earliest images of Webster City and the surrounding area, and at the same time recreating those images with the topography of 2021. That's the Webster City Postcard Project, and it's the brainchild of Kent Bailey of OHP Marketing. Bailey said the idea for the project started back in May, when he was asked to recreate an aerial image from an old Webster City postcard. We used a drone in a lot of our day-to-day work through OHP. It's become more prevalent. I seem to be using the drone in just about everything I do for video projects, he said. Bailey said he was approached by George Johnston, a local historian who collects postcards and other artifacts of the Webster City's early days. And he knew we were using the drone quite a bit and said, wouldn't it be cool if you could recreate this bird's eye view of the old postcard? Bailey said, the postcard shows an aerial view from the corner of Des Moines and Bank Streets looking northeast. There were churches that aren't there anymore. The church that used to sit where Fuller Hall is now. Bailey said he took the drone out and worked to recreate the image. I made one of the shots look older, just sort of had fun with it, and we got some positive feedback. In talking with Johnson, they thought, why stop there? Why not do recreations of all these old postcards and images? So I just started going out and taking shots. Some with a drone, some from the ground. Any of the early aerial shots were taken from the top of another building. Bailey said he felt the project was big enough endeavor that it should stand on its own, so they started the Webster City Postcard Project, including a Facebook page where they could share the photos and some history about the community. Plans call for weekly updates to the Facebook page, and additional photos can be found at ohpmarketingservices.com. George has allowed me to use a number of his images. Kendall Young Library reached out to say they had a bunch of images, and I'm open to more. If people have some old postcards or photographs that show some buildings or streetscapes, we would love to see them. Bailey recently posted a picture of Shiloh's cabin on an island in the Boone River. Shiloh came to town as a young boy in 1867 and built this cabin on an island on the Boone River, just south of the Bank Street Bridge. The images posted show the cabin and island and how the same area looks today. The story of Shiloh should be a movie script, he said. The story was documented by the late historian Ed Nass. The storylines that come up with these postcards and images are just incredible. The project is a neat way to show the community and how it's grown and changed over the past 100 plus years, as well as what has remained the same. Bailey credited Johnston and Kim Anderson for providing some of the historical background for the project, as well as McMurray Hatchery for helping with a sponsorship. It's going to be fun to see where this project goes, he says. City Councilwoman Caitlin Hartman has submitted her resignation to the council effective September 15, 2021. The resignation is on the agenda for the City Council Tuesday night, rescheduled from Monday due to the Labor Day holiday. In her letter of resignation, Hartman said she had recently purchased a home outside the city limits of Webster City, which necessitated the resignation. Hartman is currently serving her first term on the City Council. Hartman said she decided to run for city council so that she could be more involved in her community, understanding the workings of city government, and to be a voice for a different demographic of citizens. Her term was to expire December 31st, 2023. The council will determine how to find a replacement for Hartman's seat. Also on the agenda for Tuesday night, the council will consider closing the 700 block of 2nd Street for the Lift WC's Taste of Fall event scheduled for September 19th. A change order for the 2020 HMA Street Improvement Project with Fort Dodge Asphalt. Fort Dodge in the corp deducted amount of $32,709.42 will be considered. A request from Fire Chief Charles Stansfield for the purchase of turnout gear will be reviewed by the council. The board will also set a hearing on September 20th at 6:05 p.m. for the disposal of city-owned property on 2nd Street to Susan E. Erickson. A proclamation for the upcoming Doodle Bug Days is also expected to be presented. The council will meet in person in the council chambers of City Hall beginning at 6 o'clock. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will turn to today's obituary page. From Pocahontas, Donna Hull. Donna L. Hull, 81, of Brunswick, Georgia, formerly of Pocahontas, died Thursday, September 2nd at her home. Services are 11 a.m. Friday, September 10th at Powers Funeral Home. Burial in the Summit Hill Cemetery in Pocahontas. Visitation 9:30 to 11 a.m. Friday at Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas. Janice and Gaylord Nag. Services for Janice and Gaylord Nag will be 10:30 Saturday at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. Visitation is 8 a.m. until service time. At the church, Lent's Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Dakota City, Valerie Sorensen. The celebration of life for Valerie Sorensen will be 1:30 p.m. Sunday, September 12th at the Dakota City Park. Lent's Funeral Home in Humboldt is in charge of arrangements. Tim Flaherty. Timothy Patrick Flaherty, 50, of Fort Dodge, died Monday, September 6th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Services are pending at Loffisweiler Funeral Home. Thomas Engler was born on July 27, 1925, in Mason City. He grew up in Early, Iowa. It was there that he flourished as a high school athlete, playing trumpet in the school band, and was a representative of his school as a member of an all-state vocal quartet. He never tired of telling stories about some of the crucial basketball games with his teammates. Tom's parents were Cecil Francis Engler and Etoile Coral Hein Engler. His younger sister Isla was also athletic in school and beyond. Tom graduated from high school in June 1942 at the age of 16 and enrolled at Iowa State University that fall. Soon after, he joined the U.S. Navy, serving in the Asian arena during World War II. Returning as a veteran, he went back to school on the GI Bill and completed his degree in general engineering. During that time, Tom married his high school sweetheart, Jean Marie DeGiarmo. After graduation from ISU, Tom and Jean lived briefly in locations in Early and Fort Dodge while he began his career in sales for electrical engineering and equipment company. They found living in the Dodger apartments a great way to make new lifelong friends, especially buying their first home right across the street from the brand new Fred M. N. Cooper School. Tom moved his family to Urbandale, where they lived from 1961 to 63, to pursue advancement opportunities within his company. But the family missed their ties to Fort Dodge and being near to Early and extended family there. So Tom made a different career move in joining Electrical Materials Company and moving back to Fort Dodge. He was especially proud of studying hard those first years with electrical materials to complete his professional engineering certification. Eventually, Tom was able to assume the presidency of the company and to expand its size and scope with the acquisition of Layton Plumbing Supply. He valued his reputation for honesty and of being a fair employer. In 1990, Tom retired. He and Jean enjoyed travel with friends and family for several years before Jean's health prevented it. Tom enjoyed many activities outside of work, including leading Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts, coaching church league basketball, teaching Sunday school to rowdy boys, playing church league softball, serving in different capacities of leadership at First Presbyterian Church, playing bridge and cribbage, and golfing. If there was a sporting event on television, he would watch it, but his favorites were the Iowa Hawkeyes and the St. Louis Cardinals. He was a big fan of big band music. He was a loyal friend to many and a great sender of birthday and anniversary cards to family and friends. Tom was preceded in death by his parents, his infant son Ramon, his sister Isla, a son Gary, and his wife of 63 years, Jean. He was married in 2016 to Gloria Coleman von Bank Magnuson Engler, who survives him. Other survivors are daughter Rona Patterson, grandson Craig Patterson, great-grandson Kaylin, granddaughter Kara Winger, stepson Michael von Bank, stepdaughter Vicki Simpson, brother-in-law John DeGiarmo, and nieces, nephews, and their families. Family interment services were held at Union Cemetery in Early. Memorial services will be 1 p.m. Saturday, September 11th at the First Presbyterian Church. Military honors will be presented by VFW Post Number 1856 and the United States Navy Honor Guard. Those wishing to send cards may send them to Rona Patterson, P.O. Box 785, La Center, Washington 98629. Arrangements have been entrusted to Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. From Webster City, Murray Anderson. Visitation for Murray Ray Anderson will be from 2 to 3 on Friday, September 10th at the Briggs Woods Beach Shelter, followed by a memorial service at 3:30. Bowman Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Stratford, Lucretia Howd. Lucretia M. Howd, 96, of Boone and formerly of Stratford, died Friday, September 3rd at the Eastern Star Masonic Home in Boone. Graveside service for Lucretia will be held at a later date at McGuire Bend Cemetery, rural Dayton. Carson Stapp Funeral Home in Dayton has been entrusted with arrangements. Ronald Coppin. Ronald Ron M. Coppin, 82, of Fort Dodge, died Thursday, September 2nd at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Memorial services are Friday, at September 10th at 10:30 at Grace Lutheran Church. A gathering of family and friends will be held 1 hour prior to the service. Memorials may be directed to the discretion of the family. Bruce Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Kanirim, Zadana Yetmar. Zadana May Yetmar, 86, of Jacksonville, Arkansas, died August 30th, 2021. Graveside services are 11 a.m. Thursday, September 9th at Greenfield Township Cemetery at Kanirim. Palmer and Swank Funeral Home in Rockwell City is in charge of arrangements. From Odison, Rana Lounsbury. Rana M. Lounsbury, 78, of Odison, died Saturday, September 4th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Services will be Saturday, September 11th at St. Olaf Lutheran Church in Bode. Burial at St. Olaf Cemetery, Bode. Visitation 5 to 7 Friday with a prayer service at 7 o'clock at the church in Bode. Loffesweiler Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And from Sac City, Doug Jacobson. Mass of the Christian burial for Doug Jacobson will be 10:30 Thursday at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Sac City. Visitation is 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. prior to the service at the church, with the rosary service beginning at 9 a.m. Farber and Ottoman Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. That completes today's look at the obituary page. We'll head over next to the Marshalltown Times-Republican. Metal, new wave music rings through Marshalltown streets is the title of an article. Music, in one form or another, brought people in Marshalltown together during the Labor Day weekend. Marshalltown's very own movie director, Jude Rollins, brought about 20 people to West End Park in the 13th Street District for a dance sequence set to Modette's White Mice Sunday afternoon. With perfect weather and a clear sky, the dancers learned the choreography and performed the steps near the Echo sculpture as Rollins filmed it for a movie he is making called Little Johnny Jewel. This is a flash mob type of situation, Rollins said. A new wave song is playing on the radio and everyone hanging around can't help themselves and they join in. Essentially, it's the most logistically complicated scene in the whole movie, and it has nothing to do with the main story. He said the scene will also be used as a way to join some of the main movie characters together. Rollins was very happy to see everyone's enthusiasm on the set. When you're writing these and thinking them up, it's quite a lonely place, he said. With filmmaking, you spend all this time coming up with it, but then you need other people in situations like this. When you see everyone joining in and being enthusiastic and having a good time, it's like I created that. It's things I like this I like to take away from it. Rollins said the Sunday dance scene shows him the people involved really believe in film, and the further into the production he gets, the more proof there is a movie God looking out for it. It feels like he is on our side with this one because of the weather, the permits, and organizing everything we had one shot at today. You couldn't have planned it better. It feels like something wants this to happen. Little Johnny Jewel is a comedy drama about second chances, about a drifter who is estranged from his parents, and they are forced to take responsibility for him again. Rollins managed to hire Juliet Landau of the Buffy the Vampire Slayer fame to star in the motion picture. He said she will be in Marshalltown in October. To get dancers, Rollins called a few people to spread the word for Marshalltown residents to show up and dance. He was hoping for 15 attendees, so he was happy with the turnout and that they all learned the steps rather quickly. Rollins is estimating filming of Little Johnny Jewel will be complete by October 25th if everything stays on schedule, provided the COVID-19 pandemic allows that. He is editing the movie as the filming is done to help save time. We hope to have a local screening by early next year, I think. We will at least invite everybody involved in the film so they can see what they got themselves into, Rollins said, laughing. In another historic Marshalltown neighborhood, the Labor Fest, Marshalltown Metal Militia and Dave and Sally's Bar was held Saturday and Sunday. The heavy metal festival brought roughly 250 people to downtown Marshalltown. Organizer Elik Verdula said the event went very well and fulfilled the intention to bring people together. I think Marshalltown needs a lot of that interaction, especially after the whole COVID thing. We need to get our economy back up and going. We need to start being more involved. The ability to get away from the daily routine and being able to release has been welcome, Verdula said. The fact there were no fights during the two-day event just made the experience all the more sweeter. It's been a great environment, he said. Verdula thought a lot of the people who attended the festival were not the typical metalheads, but rather those who bucked the stereotype and were tired of being at home. He was just happy to provide an event for people to just get out in Marshalltown. As long as they are getting out and expressing themselves in a positive way and not getting into trouble, that's the only thing I'm looking at, Verdula said. I don't want to be bigger or better. I just want to bring people together. And I head back to the Messenger newspaper and take a look at some other stories that we may have missed. Many Iowans are exploring how to home preserve their garden bounty to enjoy it all year long. Learn how to safely preserve that fresh taste of summer during upcoming free one-hour online food preservation classes from Iowa State University and Outreach. Preserve the taste of summer, all about apples, during this one-hour session. You will learn the proper ways to safely can, freeze, and dry apples from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. on September 13th. While participation in these sessions is complimentary, registration is required. Reserve your spot today at extension.iastate.edu/humansciences/events. For more information, contact Holly Van Heel, Iowa State Extension and Outreach Human Sciences Specialist Nutrition and Wellness, at 515-576-2119. That's 576-2119. A reminder, Trinity Regional Medical Center is holding health screenings September 9th and 13th. Community blood work screenings will be held from 7 a.m. to noon on September 9th. Stroke and vascular screenings will be held on September 13th. Appointment times are required for both screenings. Call Tammy Davis, RN, at 574-6505 for more information or to schedule an appointment. Country school enthusiasts will gather in Sac County October 8th and 9th to celebrate Iowa's rich history of education and agriculture. The two-day conference will feature tours of several well-preserved rural schools, speakers, and the opportunity to learn about the interaction between agriculture and educational programs from the past 150 years. Janet Secor of Fort Dodge and Bruce Perry of Sac City will be two of the featured speakers. The annual statewide conference is open to all who love history and enjoy sharing stories. The program will begin in Odebolt, home to one of the finest rural school museums in Iowa. In addition to participating in programs about the preservation of country schools and family connections to country schools, attendees will visit preserved country schools in Odebolt, Sac City, and surrounding areas. As communities sprang up on the prairie, public schools were among the highest priorities for new settlers. Parents' desire to improve their children's lives inspired the conference theme, One Room Schools, the Start of Big Dreams. Attendees will visit Sac City Chautauqua Pavilion, which was home to yearly county 8th grade graduation ceremonies, have dinner in the Sac Community Center, which is a repurposed school, and visit the Peterson Pioneer Home in Odebolt to get a taste of life in the early years of Sac County. Additional attractions will include towers of the Adams Bank, now known as First State Bank, Grant No. 5 Schoolhouse at Moorhead Park, and Prairie Peddler visiting Cook No. 8 Schoolhouse, the Peddler Gardens, and Sears Prefabricated Barn. Pre-registration is encouraged. Forms are available at www.iowaruralschoolsmuseum.net or by calling 712-668-4285. This event is sponsored by Preservation Iowa Rural Legacy Project, Iowa Rural Schools Museum of Odebolt, First State Bank, City of Sac City, Tlobito Questers, No. 485, Odebolt Historical Museum, Sac City Historical Museum and Village, Odebolt Betterment Committee, Prairie Peddler, and the Western Iowa Tourism. We'll take a look next at some stories from the Fort Dodge Sports section. Quinnell McCaleb notes it's impossible to properly thank nurses and first responders for their selfless, unwavering commitment to the Fort Dodge community. He's just hoping this week's recognition at Dodger athletic events, in its own simple way, be the ray of hope many of them need in a time of stress and turmoil. McCaleb and the Dodger Experience Organization are partnering with Fort Dodge Senior High to offer free admission with a work identification for any Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center worker who attends the school's volleyball match on Tuesday or varsity football game this Friday. It's honestly the least we could do with everything going on in the world today and everything they're going through, said McCaleb, whose wife Lacey is a nurse. Knowing how busy every single one of them are and how much they do for the people in our community every day without ever expecting attention or anything other than a thank you. We just want to let them know that we care and hope it will be a morale boost at a time many of them really need it. A chance to get away, decompress a little bit, enjoy themselves, and know Fort Dodge is behind you and supporting you, honoring them in the Dodger way. McCaleb confirmed the plans are to have a moment of recognition for the workers in attendance. He is also encouraging all fans to wear navy blue as a way of paying tribute to local nurses and first responders. I think it's important not just for the community in general, but the kids to also see what these people mean to and do for us, he said. It's natural for teenagers to take life for granted unless they're directly affected by something that the work these heroes do often goes unnoticed. So it's important to raise awareness, step back, and look at their sacrifices from a different perspective. We've got some things planned for both events on Tuesday and Friday, especially with it being 9/11 week. The 20th anniversary of 9/11 is this Saturday. We want to take the time and thank them for always being there for us. Fort Dodge Police Chief Roger Porter, who also volunteers with the Dodger Experience Program, echoed McCaleb's sentiments. With 9/11 coming up and the COVID-19 still a serious issue in our communities, now is a good time to both recognize and honor the people who spend their professional lives helping others every single day, Porter said. We don't want to lose sight of the fact that the overwhelming majority of workers who choose these professions do it for the right reasons, to serve and to save. Quinnell first told me about this idea over a year ago. This just seems to be the perfect week for it. Timing-wise, it's a public and a positive way to say thank you. New Fort Dodge Senior High Activities Director Josh Porter called it an honor to work with the Dodger Experience on this endeavor. I think the biggest thing, aside from the importance of recognizing them and thanking them and giving them a night to escape, so to speak, is to make sure our kids understand the important roles nurses and first responders play in our community, said Porter. Like McCaleb and Roger Porter, a senior high graduate, we're in the business of not only educating kids, but teaching them the importance of both respect and perspective. There are a lot bigger and more important things going on in this world than athletic activity and activities. It's good for them to bring their work to light so we can collectively appreciate their service. It's been a tough stretch for all of them, the last few years especially. We can't remove the pressure or burden they feel, but in our own way, we'd like to at the very least, let them know their commitment and passion for helping others isn't something we take for granted. Dodger Experience Initiative was founded in 2020 with the intent of raising awareness and incorporating younger students in local athletics, activities, and community relations through a mentoring program. McCaleb is also seeking help to arrange gift baskets, which will go to nurses and staff members at Unity Point, Fort Dodge location. Donation opportunities are available at Fort Dodge Avila Bank into the Dodger Experience account. A mix of savvy experience and youthful enthusiasm has Fort Dodge girls swimming coach Ashley Beaumont looking forward to her team's long-anticipated 2021 debut. The Dodgers are opening their season a week later than most squads, beginning with a Tuesday road trip to Southeast Polk that suits Beaumont just fine. It's just the way the schedule was set up for us. Most CIML programs had their first meets last week. I think that it's going to help us, though. We didn't have to rush to get ready. We got an extra week of training in. The girls are definitely excited. Seeing other times posted already just has them eager to get started. Junior Eileen Fierick is Fort Dodge's linchpin this fall after earning a pair of top 10 finishes at the state meet a year ago. She took 6th in the 200 and 8th in the 200 freestyle and 8th in the 100 breaststroke. Sophomore Reagan Wooldridge, a student at Manson Northwest Webster, is also ready to take a big step forward after qualifying for state in 2020. Eileen and Reagan will be able to build from what they did at Marshalltown as underclassmen. Eileen made the podium and reached the A finals in both events. Eileen and Reagan were also on two of our qualifying relays. We just need Eileen to keep pushing and continuing to improve, and Reagan is ready to stand out on her own in individual events. They could both be difference makers for us. A total of 12 letter winners are back, including an outstanding senior class of six swimmers who bring so much positive energy to the table. Our captains are Isabel Berger and Maria Elizondo, Beaumont said. They're so incredibly supportive of everyone, and they know what to expect as senior leaders. It's just a great group of kids I've been blessed to have for the last 3 or 4 years. First-team All-State softball player Jalen Adams brings her state championship experience from this past summer to the table. As one of those seniors, along with Olivia Anderson, Emma Johnston, and Kieran Pontes. Beaumont noted that junior McKenna Kammerer will help bridge the gap of losing state swimmers Grace Hartley, Riley Steinkamp, and Claire Kinzel to graduation. We're seeing her times really drop, Beaumont said. McKenna is very versatile and wants to step up. She's one of the hardest workers we have, and I think she's ready to make a difference. The Dodgers' home opener is this Thursday against Algona and Sioux City. The annual Gary Winkler Invitational is scheduled for September 18th. Let's go ahead and take a look at this date in history. It is September 7th. On this date, the United States nicknamed Uncle Sam. The name is linked to Samuel Wilson, a meat packer from Troy, New York, who supplied barrels of beef to the United States Army during the War of 1812. In 1968, protesters disrupted the Miss American pageant. As the contestants walked across the stage, protesters unfurled a bedsheet turned political statement from the rafters that read "Women's Liberation" in large letters. The women shouted "No more Miss America" over the crowd in the first ever protest against Miss America. While they didn't get on camera, their words hit print in the next day's newspaper, dragging the second wave of feminism into the mainstream. Also on this date, in 1776, the world's first submarine attack took place. In 1911, Guillaume Apollinaire is arrested for stealing the Mona Lisa. On this date in 1936, rock and roll legend Buddy Holly was born. In 1864, the city of Atlanta was evacuated during the Civil War. In 1876, Minnesotans attached the James Younger criminal gang. In 1996, Tupac Shakur was shot. 1977, the United States agreed to transfer the Panama Canal to Panama. And during World War II in 1940, the Blitz began as Germany started their bombing of London. And that's just a handful of things that happened on this date, September 7th. We'll go ahead and take a look at the weather forecast. Wednesday looks beautiful with a high of 77 under clear skies, 49 degrees for a low. Thursday, mostly clear, high of 77, low of 55. Friday, mostly clear, warming up to 87 with a low of 62. Saturday, partly cloudy, high of 84, low of 55. Sunday, partly cloudy, high of 79, low of 57. And we're looking at temperatures on Monday with a high of 83 degrees. So no rain in the forecast. I know the farmers are getting ready to start their harvest, so that should be cranking up before too long. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger with some help from the Daily Freeman Journal of Webster City and the Marshalltown Times Republican. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Of course, this podcast and many others are available to you at iowaradioreading.org. And we thank you for your continued support of IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Stay safe, stay healthy, take good care of yourselves even. And we'll talk to you again real soon right here on IRIS.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home, so take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors, and install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.